This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, and Mark Ballard of The Advocate is with us to begin our show a little earlier than most Thursdays, but we're glad we're having him on, and much is percolating at the Capitol with 2 weeks to go in the legislative session. Your number, 877-217-5757. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. High drama in the battle over who is chairing the House Education Committee. That's a front page story today in The Advocate. And Ray Garofalo is out as the chair after making some incendiary comments. And it was certainly a showdown among ranking Republicans, Mark Ballard.
Well, yeah, it has been for much of the session. Have to do, but basically, Garofalo last week, forgive me because all my things are running together, but I said, you know, well, I've been kicked off as chairman of the House Education Committee, but the House Speaker, Sheck Snyder, said, wouldn't say one way or the other whether that was true or not. So Garofalo decided to show up and chair the Education Committee hearing yesterday, which still has quite a few major bills in it. Basically, Sheck Snyder threatened to remove him from the building if he did that. But then he called the members of the committee and say, don't show up for it. And they all sat in their seats in the chamber. Not all Beryl Amity from HOMA showed up to show support. But the rest of them sat in the House chamber, not in the committee room. And then after about an hour, they had to give up because they didn't have a quorum to set the meeting and go home. And then later in the day, Sheck Snyder decided that it was time to, you know, actually say something about it. And he officially fired him as the chairman of the Education Committee.
And this is a battle among GOP titans. And here is Representative Garofalo describing his interaction with Speaker Sheck Snyder.
It's embarrassing for me, and it's humiliating for me if you have me listed as chairman, but you won't let me do the job that you've appointed me to. At one point, he threatened to have me removed from the building if I went and sat in the chair. Then he said, I'm just going to cancel the meeting. And things got a little heated, and I just went up to do my duty.
All right, so Republicans are starting to act like Democrats did when they had a supermajority in the House and Senate, and now there is friction in the ranks. Is this a big deal, or will this go away?
Oh, I think it's a big deal. I mean, we basically are factionalizing. There is Jack McFarland, who is a conservative from North Louisiana, kind of put together a by invitation only conservative caucus among House members. And, saying, you know, we want to do practical things and get practical things done and not get wrapped up in these culture wars that another group of Republicans have wanted to take a part in. So, yes, there's lots of division.
Well, on the Senate side, the Republican leader who has gotten a lot of attention of late is Bodie White, the gentleman who almost won the Baton Rouge mayoral race in 2016, receiving 48% of the votes. And he's been a busy bee in getting involved in matters pertaining to East Baton Rouge Parish. And I was at Louis's this morning, as I am on most days, and Collis Temple told me he had to leave. He was going for an 8 o'clock press conference with Bodie White, and I presume this is about Breck. A little birdie tells me that, and I think Bodie has decided to pull back.
Well, that's not been confirmed yet, but we had been hearing that all day yesterday, that that this has gone further than what Bodie wanted to do. That we've heard that that's the case, but the man himself has said no. But it is on the schedule, still on the schedule for a vote today.
Well, there's a story today above the fold by Paul Cumbler of your staff. Breck leader dispute led to breakup. Bill Wilson, that's Corey Wilson, says White upset about baseball field scheduling conflict. By the way, Corey Wilson is slated to be with us tomorrow. But sometimes these little things become big things.
Well, this is true, and this could be very well one of these things. I often took the fact that remember that when Bodie White ran for mayor, that his main support came out of Zachary, came out of Central, came out of what would be St. George if they were able to break away, and so you know he has a lot of support in those areas, and that could be also play a role in it.
877-217-5757 for Mark Ballard at the Capitol, where he heads the Bureau for the Advocate, and a film tax credit bill is apparently going to have success. And this one, some are surprised, would extend what we have until 2028. How did this come about?
Well, I mean, it was slipped in, and we have several of those that were kind of slipped in at the end. The bill was supposed to kind of redistribute the buckets of money that come from the film tax credits so that the areas outside of New Orleans would be able to get kind of more incentives to get those filmmakers to leave Orleans Parish and go somewhere else to do their movies. But also in there, it was sort of tacked on at the end as saying, and we'll extend it to 2028. Now the sponsor says, well, really, the film industry wanted 2031, so see, this is a compromise. But it's been plowing through the legislature. It could get its final vote as early as today, and be sent up to the governor's desk.
877-217-5757, and a listener notes the Advocate opined about this on its editorial pages today. Now, Mark doesn't write editorials, but obviously the Advocate, with a headline that reads, Louisiana can't waste enough money when it comes to Hollywood, does not think this is money well spent, Mark.
Yes, and I don't write editorials, so, yes, the top editors and owners of the newspaper do believe that this is not money well spent. It's the third largest tax exemption that we have, and it's larger than some of the others that you hear a lot about, like the inventory tax, like the federal deduction exemption. And it's huge, but we don't get a whole lot of money out of it. The state recoups about 22 cents for every dollar that it gives in credits, which can be written off by these film producers, or it can be sold back to the state for a check at 90% of the face value. And when you look at other giveaways like the Quality Jobs Program, that's recoups about 75 cents up to a dollar or so for every dollar that is credited. And so there are many people who believe that 22 cents is not a good return on investment, particularly when you're talking about $180 million a year.
Now, we're going to get to more legislative action with Mark, but another erudite listener, this is Kelly in Mid-City, asks about this story that was yesterday from Laura Nicholson and Joe Guyon about people actually being pulled off the street for jury duty. This is a highly unusual maneuver, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And now, all I know about this is what I read in Joe Guyon's story, but it sounds like, being shanghaied, while you're going out to get lunch, if you're a voter without a felony.
And it's just there. They ask you, do you have any felonies? And if you say no, it's like, according to this one who got called, we got another.
Well, there is a bill in the legislature that would allow convicted felons who have served their time and have been out of prison and finished their sentence for 5 years before to serve on juries. It's a controversial bill, but maybe that'll help out so that some of the rest of us don't get shanghaied at lunch.
Police reform bill. This one is Senator Cleo Fields. That one is getting some traction. What's going on there?
We're going to have to see how this all ends up, but this is basically kind of a training to de-escalate, you know, better training for de-escalation. They're trying to get, better body cams and to try to avoid or make it harder for a police officer to claim qualified mm-hmm. immunity. And a lot of this is coming from the problems that some of our law enforcement officers have had with the minority communities over the past decades.
Well, and some of those, of course, are high profile as we speak. And we will talk with Mark Ballard. And again, if you would like to participate in the on-air conversation, your Talk Louisiana number is 877-217-5757. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us. Mark Ballard is with us to talk politics at the Capitol and beyond. And if you wish to participate, 877-217-5757. Producer Matt Doyle is ready to take your inquiry, and you can send emails, as mentioned, to talk@talklouisiana.org. With the Capitol buzzing with 2 weeks remaining in the session, yesterday a Senate panel killed legislation to overhaul river pilot regulations and oversight. This one was a hot potato. What happened, Mark?
Well, it was a hot potato, and it goes to show that how much power that the river pilots have, in that they are, along with the nursing home industry and the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry, those are the top three givers to legislative campaigns, to political campaigns. And, apparently lawmakers have watched that. There's also a problem is that the main pushers of that bill, which is to try to limit the massive amounts of money that these blue-collar workers make, that the main pushers of that bill, you know, make more money than they do, than the river pilots do. So there was that kind of issue floating around as well. But it's done for this session, and they'll probably try to bring it up again next year. That's what we hear.
Those river pilots, they make ungodly amounts of money.
$450,000 a year. That's generally what they make, which is, you know, a little less than you make, Jim, but a lot less than some of the trade associations that wanted to limit their pay.
Yeah, when I grow up, I want to be a river pilot. How about that?
Me too, but that's also part of the problem is that that to get in there, it's like a very small fraternity in which it's good to have someone already in it, a family member already a river pilot, or to be a politician.
So there are generations of river pilots then.
Yes, yes. I mean, and it's not a job that you and I can apply for.
Well, I would imagine the line would be long for a $500,000 a year job. That's almost what the new president at LSU will earn, William Tate IV.
I imagine he's going to earn more.
Yeah, it looks like he's in a pretty good bargaining position. But I saw Robert Damp this morning, the chair of the board, and he says he's ours. He's not staying at South Carolina, so he's confident. Now, Bill, another listener, this one is Holly in the Garden District, noting the bill to have full-out legalization of marijuana fell short, but decriminalizing it has a shot. Where is it right now?
I will have to double-check, but it's going to voted on by the full Senate, and yes, the decriminalization has a real shot at being passed this year. And the legalization, they'll study it, they'll deal with it in future sessions.
Mitchell in Sherwood. Mitchell, you're on with Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine.
I just want to say about the tax breaks for the Fortune 500 companies. That's just corruption in high places. Our politicians is corrupt. That's what it all equals to. And as far as the riverboat situation, that's a fraternity of white men. You'll never get in there if you any other color. God bless.
All right. Well, that's an interesting point. Are there any people of color who are riverboat pilots?
Apparently there is one. and there is one woman. And that was brought about after that issue was brought up, as the caller brought up, several years ago, saying, you know, that it's a fraternity and there's no diversity at all in there. And
how many are there, Mark? Ballpark? How many riverboat pilots are there in the state?
Oh, I don't know if I can give you a ballpark answer on that. You know, dozens at least.
Okay. A bill that would give LSU superstars and others around the state some sustenance if they could sell their name, their likeness, their image. That one is still in the offing. What do you think?
It probably is going to happen. That was one of the bills held up with this kind of imbroglio over the Education Committee. They are meeting again. Education Committee are going to try to meet this morning with the interim chairman, Mark Wright from Covington, taking control. And mainly it was to pass that bill and a couple of others that need to get passed before next week or they won't be passed at all.
Okay. Tom on Blue Bonnet asks about this national anthem bill. What is this?
This one I don't know that much about.
Okay.
It's they want to have it sung at particular sporting events or specific events, you know, and I think that they go beyond the sporting events. But that's one that has been under the radar for the time.
Okay. Buddy Romer died last week, and his services are continuing with one today in Shreveport, where he spent his youth, and yesterday, or actually Tuesday, in Baton Rouge. Many of his friends and family said goodbye to the 52nd Louisiana governor, and Mark, you knew Buddy Romer, and he was a character.
He was, you know, a very kind of real person, but and was able to kind of talk to you at whatever level you were at, and so I mean, he will be missed, I think, and I believe that today we kind of said goodbye to him on Tuesday, and today he will be. Actually, the actual funeral is taking place in Shreveport. And, I think he was a great but misunderstood governor.
His daughter, Caroline, told me that he was buried in a New York Yankees jersey that read, Romer number one.
Well, other than being a Yankees fan, but I guess, you know, everybody has the... Everybody's allowed to have their own prejudices.
Well, he would have given up everything to be shortstop for the New York Yankees, but he was not Phil Rizzuto. He was Buddy Romer, and he did lead one of the most amazing campaigns in state history, vaulting from fifth to first in 1987, and then one of the most surprising collapses in Louisiana history, a race he was heavily favored in and would have won in a runoff against either of the major opponents, David Duke or Edwin Edwards, but he somehow, some way, Mark, managed to finish third.
Yes, but I think that a large part of that is kind of the politics of Louisiana that he did not totally grasp. I mean, I think that that Edwin Edwards probably made the biggest, sharpest strategical move by not running, going into the runoff against him 4 years earlier. So he never really beat Edwin Edwards. He never really, made a definitive statement about it. And Edwin was able to just kind of hold off for a few years like he did during the Treat administration. And then at the same time, you had this growth of the far right, and they went behind David Duke for a while. And I think that's all of that kind of played into, and I think that Buddy Romer never really noticed.
Well, he ran a poor campaign in 91, and some say he ran a campaign beneath him in 95 when he went far right, but he couldn't get to the right of Mike Foster, and Mike Foster ended up running first. The four candidates were blanketed real close together, though. It was Foster, Fields, Landrieu, and Romer, and Phil Price actually ran a good race, and he was fifth. Melinda Schwegman ran sixth. It was an all-star cast, but 1995 was the Mike Foster year. And it is curious, Foster, a listener notes, Foster and Romer have both gone without as much fanfare as Kathleen Blanco. Some governors are just, they could become more beloved after they leave office.
Well, that's true, and it's also true of presidents as well. But, I mean, yes, Foster was able to pull off the big move the same way that Romer had done when he ran the first time for governor. So,
and Foster changed parties that year at age 57. After being a Democrat for 57 years, he became a newborn Republican. And he put on a welder's mask, and the rest is history, as they say. And he drew Cleo Fields in a runoff. He might have very well lost at that time to Mary Loretta Landrieu. We'll spend a few more minutes with Mark Ballard, then hear from Dr. Gerald Militello of the Hematology and Oncology Center back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We turn the page and are joined now by Dr. Gerald Militello. He's been practicing for 31 years. He's an oncologist, and he's with the Hematology and Oncology Clinic here in Baton Rouge, an underwriter of WRKF. And he's here to talk about a few matters, and he does important work in our community. Many have known Dr. Militello for his 30 years of service. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. But this is Skin Cancer Awareness Month, and there are more episodes now of things like melanoma, carcinoma. Dr. Militello, do we take good enough care of our skin, in particular like sunscreen and staying away from heavy doses of sun, or are we still living as though there's no tomorrow?
I think, unfortunately, we're living as there's no tomorrow. There, skin cancer is the number one cancer in this country. Over 5.4 million cases per year, with basal cell carcinoma being the number one, squamous cell number two, and melanoma the third. And of all the three, melanoma is the most deadly of the skin cancers. And unfortunately, it's something that we can prevent if we just take some simple precautions. And 30 years ago, people really didn't realize this, and so that's why we're seeing all these cases now. But if we could educate the public on how to prevent skin cancer, we could save lives, save people lots of trips to the doctor's office. And it's a simple thing, just avoiding the sun. And we are noted skin sun worshipers in Louisiana, with all the outdoor activities, the beach, and you can do simple things just wearing sunscreen, and you should really wear sunscreen year-round, at least the number 15.
It's a case in which a person like you, I see you have a nice olive complexion, you may be more resistant to sun cancer or skin cancer than somebody like me from the sun. So does a person with fairer skin have more of a risk?
Absolutely. Thank God I was blessed with dark skin, but light skin, redheads, blonde hair, blue eyes, green eyes, those people are at a much higher risk. Anyone who burns easily is at a much higher risk for skin cancer than someone who's olive complected. So whites compared to blacks is a much higher incidence. Men have a higher incidence of cancer than women.
Well, it's a case I've heard, Dr. Militello, that a person like me, when I was a kid, and we're talking in the 60s and 70s, we didn't know as much then, and I got some severe sunburns. Those can come back to bite you years later, can't they?
That's exactly what we're seeing now. Because we didn't, in the 60s and 70s, people weren't wearing sunscreen. They just didn't know it. And even now, you should put your sun, you should wear at least the number 30 sunscreen. You should put it on before you go out in the sun.
And even if you're just going to work.
Right.
You should do it.
If you're going to be out in the at the beach and you're getting wet, you should reapply sunscreen every 2 hours. You should put it on, like I said, 30 minutes before you go out to give it a chance to be absorbed, and it's much more protective. Children under 6 months of age really need to avoid the skin, and anybody over 6 months of age needs to be coated before they go out. And there's simple things you can do. Wearing hats. Another thing is wearing dark clothing. If you're going to be out, dark clothing reflects the sun a lot better than pastels and light-colored clothing.
Really? Is there some sunscreen that's better than others?
Not really. I mean, as long as you're doing an SPF of 30 or greater, I think you're well protected.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Gerald Militello from the Hematology and Oncology Clinic. And we're talking about Skin Cancer Awareness Month, and skin cancer is almost, it's universally caused by sun damage, isn't it?
Sun damage and tanning beds. Tanning beds,
which is
UV light.
A hybrid, but...
Right.
But, yeah, those can be even more dangerous than the actual sun if you're in there enough, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And people quite often don't wear sunscreen when they go to a tanning bed, do they?
No.
No. So, does that become more and more of a problem?
It is. And the other thing besides the tanning beds are the UV lights that they're using at the nail places where they work on your nails and mm-hmm. they're putting their hands under the UV light. Those people are having an increased risk of cancers on their fingers. And so it's the UV light is just bad no matter where you get it. But paying for it is even worse.
Yeah. 106,000 new cases in the U.S. each year of melanoma, and 7,000 die of the disease every year. So I guess we're talking about a mortality rate, if you do the math there, of around 7%. And people quite often get removal, and then we have cancer erupt somewhere else. Is that something you deal with on a frequent basis?
Yes. With the basal cell carcinomas, we now, for the first time, actually have a drug that we're using to treat this. With melanoma, we've made major progress with melanoma just in the past 5 years. We now have a type of immunotherapy that we're using. We're not curing people, but we are buying people years, whereas 5 years ago, we literally had nothing. We have an interleukin program, which is a type of immunotherapy, and I've got people out 15 years on this. It's an excellent program. It's for patients with stage 4 melanoma that spread to other parts of the body. So we now have things to offer that we never did before. Between the Libtayo for the basal cell carcinomas, and fortunately, we see very few basal cell carcinomas that have spread because mm-hmm. they're treated locally.
Well, we're talking about metastatic melanoma. Now, of the 106,000 cases, about how many people will end up having a relapse of some kind?
The majority.
The majority? Mm-hmm. Really? So once you get it, you're probably going to, unfortunately, get it again?
Right. And I've seen melanomas where people had a mole that was removed 20 years ago, and they show up 20 years later with widespread disease.
My goodness. Laverne in Mid-City. Laverne, you're on with Dr. Gerald Militello.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Militello. Dr. Militello, I've been hearing a lot about people having a deficit of vitamin D in their systems. Is that because of the use of sunscreen and avoidance of the sun altogether?
Not really. Not as far as we know. I mean, you don't need that much sun exposure to help to keep your vitamin D levels up. And we're really not certain exactly what the vitamin D is doing. We're now checking vitamin D levels, but I don't think anybody's 100% sure of all the benefits of the vitamin D. Mm-hmm. But wearing sunscreen will not prevent you from getting the adequate amount of vitamin D.
A listener asked a good question. Here's an example of somebody who had multiple bouts of melanoma, John McCain, the former U.S. senator, and then he got brain cancer. Could they have been related?
Very likely they were. And I think this was the melanoma that had spread to his brain.
Hmm. John on Perkins Road. John, you're on with Dr. Militello. Hi, John.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Militello. I just wanted to say I've been a patient of his for 11 years, and, you know, he saved my life. So I wanted to thank him and just say, you know, people get cancer, and some of them give up. Some of them fight it all the way, most somewhere in between. But he made me a fighter, and we won. So just wanted to thank him.
Thank you. That's a success story. You like to hear those, don't you?
I sure do.
How effective is this therapy that you were talking about that is relatively new?
We're seeing about a 19% response rate, about a 10% complete response rate. Those people that have a complete response do have a potential for long-term survival. My longest survivor now is first patient I treated about 16 years ago who's still in remission. So it's not a cure, but it's definitely something out there that we have to offer. We have the only interleukin center in southern United States.
Randy and Zachary. Hi, Randy. Randy.
Good morning, doctor. Yes, I'm going to go out to the store and buy myself some sunscreen. So that's a good thing, dude. It's for everybody to do.
All right. Well, sometimes people have to be reminded to do things that are important. Sunscreen, if used properly and continuously, is that a panacea? Does it stop it altogether?
Not 100%, but it gets you very close to that. I mean, that's our only avoiding the sun and the sunscreen are the two best things you can do.
But it's always better to take action, even if you've had sunburns through the years, as I've had. And are most of your patients lighter skinned like me?
Probably 50%.
And that probably isn't 50% of the population.
No.
So there you go. There you go. So be safe. And Dr. Militello, you keep up your good work. Glad you're a big part of our community. Good to see you. He does important work at the Hematology and Oncology Clinic. We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Matt reports that the college athletes endorsement bill has passed a House committee, is now headed to the House floor. So this is something that would be a potential game changer. You know, LSU is one of the big entities when it comes to athletes who go pro and get drafted, and quite often they're big stars when they're in college, and some would say it would be appropriate for them to cash in, and they might stay here longer too if they were able to reap the harvest while they are still collegians. We are trying to make contact with Edward Isaac DeVore. He's a fascinating journalist, writes for The Atlantic, and he has the quote inside story about how the embattled Democratic Party, seeking a direction for its future during the Trump years, successfully regained the White House. And we're pleased to be joined now by Isaac DeVore. And good morning to you, sir.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, you capture this fascination that the Democratic Party has, as does the Republican Party, for the 45th president. And the fascination is much different. It might be better termed revulsion. And the revulsion is in full bloom with Donald Trump's predecessor, Barack Obama. You managed to get some quotes from Obama that couldn't be repeated on this program. Barack Obama, and for good reason. After all, Trump lied about Obama's birthplace for many years and has never really acknowledged that he was wrong. And that's how his political career was spawned. he picked a fight with 44, and that fight continues, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's more than the personal dynamics there, though I think you're right to point out that the birtherism left a scar on Obama. Obama looking at what was happening in the White House, in politics, in the country, and going through a process over the Trump years that I think tracks with what a lot of Democrats were going through, and even a lot of people who weren't Democrats and thinking about Trump, thinking like, okay, like this is crazy that Trump won, but let's see what this is like, to then getting more and more intense as things went. And yes, there's some choice words in there that he had that beyond the cursing that was coming out, and I won't get your censors on you by repeating the specific language, but he's reacting to what he's seeing. So, for example, there's a moment where he is talking about how he's reacting to Trump meeting with the Russian ambassador in the Oval Office. Talking to foreign leaders without other aides on the call, which is really not the way the protocol for this usually goes. And he calls him a corrupt MF-er because he's like, what is going on there? Why is he doing this? What is he up to? Which, honestly, I think a lot of people felt about President Trump when that was going on. Obama is reflecting that himself. But again, that's part of the process that I track in this book, really getting inside with what was going on with Obama, with Biden, with all the candidates who are running as they try to sort out what's going on and what to make of it.
The book is Battle for the Soul and Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Donald Trump. And the former president called Donald Trump, the former president Barack Obama, called Trump a madman, a racist, a sexist pig, a lunatic, and a corrupt MF-er. So he let it all hang out. And as we know, Obama is a measured man. He doesn't usually say these kinds of things about just everybody. But somehow Trump got under his skin.
Yeah, got under a lot of people's skin. And I think what you see in public was that Obama was being very careful to not get into a fight with Trump, to not give him fodder, to advance things politically for himself. But Obama was responding to this and reacting to it and consuming it like everybody else was. And that's a part, again, part of what I tried to do in this book is give people a sense of, yes, this is what you were seeing in public, but if you want to know what was going on in people's heads and private conversations that were defining what was happening, that's what you can get in this book. Another piece of it, of course, what Obama was doing is ways that have never been reported before, talking with all the different candidates who are running for the Democratic nomination, from Joe Biden to Bernie Sanders to Pete Buttigieg to Elizabeth Warren, all of them, working them through. In some ways, it was to just be the happy former president cheering them on. In some ways, it was almost like a therapist for Biden at points, and for others, it was to talk about them politically. You see, for example, a path that I trace of how in 2016, he was very dismissive of Bernie Sanders and not at all interested in pulling Bernie Sanders into the fold. And part of the lesson that Obama learned from that, and that I think a lot of Democrats learned from what happened in 2016 and the way that things broke down between Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters, was how to make sure that didn't happen again in 2020. And Obama is very studious about making sure that he is establishing that connection with Sanders from early out, building a relationship so that then you see this way that he was involved in talking Sanders through the end of Sanders' primary campaign. Details of this, which were shocking to me, actually, as I was reporting them, is seeing how involved and intense Obama got. That's what you see going on here, and it was only possible because Sanders and Obama had established this relationship over the years.
If Bernie had stayed the course, or if another person had received the nomination, it appears it might have been a difficult lift to win the election.
Well, if you look at what happened, obviously Biden won with 7 million more votes. That's a lot. And The other thing, though, that was going on was that if you switch about 77,000 votes in four states, Donald Trump would have had the total to win the Electoral College. I'm not sure what would have happened in the country if still the circumstances had been the same, that Biden had won by roughly 7 million votes, but still Trump had, for the second time, won the Electoral College without the popular vote. But you see that an election that was, on the one hand, not tight was also tight. And the specific coalition that, that Biden built is one that that it's hard to see another candidate building, whoever that candidate would have been. It doesn't mean that someone else couldn't have won. In fact, Sanders folks believe he would have won. But, for example, there's someone that I quote in the book, a friend of Kamala Harris, who says after the riot, I was talking to this person so in January, and said to me, look, it was so hard for the presidential campaign, for Harris's presidential campaign, to finish. I believed in it so much. I really wanted her to win. But in the end, I'm so glad she didn't win the nomination, because if she had, I think she would have lost. Trump would have been reelected, and I would have had to throw myself off the Golden Gate Bridge.
The book Battle for the Soul: Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump, from Edward Isaac Dovere. And the Atlantic article in which Trump called veterans suckers and losers, that one got under Biden's skin, didn't it?
Yeah, well, like, Biden is not just somebody who's served in government for a long time, but importantly, he has a connection to his late son, Beau, that is, all fathers and sons have deep connections, but it's much more intense with Biden. I think part of it is because Beau died in 2015, and that has shaped Joe Biden completely in the years since then. Beau Biden served in the National Guard, and he served in Iraq, and he was the Attorney General of Delaware at one point when his service came up, and he went and served and had someone else run the AG's office while he was doing that. When he died, the National Guard in Delaware gave Joe Biden a gold star, an honorary gold star. Obviously, Beau Biden didn't die in battle, so it's not a real gold star, but it was to say what an honor they were giving Beau Biden. And Joe Biden often carries it in his pocket. And I was with him the day that that article published, and he was talking about how he was watching TV and he was getting so angry that he had to take the star out of his pocket, because he was worried that having it there and feeling Beau's presence that way would make him so upset and angry that he wouldn't be able to even talk about what he was talking about. And he was doing a press conference about talking about the economy, right? And what he wanted to talk about that day was K-shaped recovery in the economy after the pandemic, the term that they were using then for rich getting richer and the poor getting poor. It was very off topic from what was going on with the military and what Trump had said about military families. But it was furious. And as I think everybody knows about Joe Biden, he's a man who feels a lot of emotions very strongly. At one point in the book, I compare him to that scene in Anchorman when Will Ferrell is banging on the doors of a phone booth and he says, "I'm in a glass cage of emotion." Like, that's Joe Biden all the time. Sometimes that's emotion over grief. Sometimes it's emotion over happiness. Sometimes it's emotion over other passions. This is just anger, real deep anger. And then what happens then over the course of the next week is that then there's Bob Woodward's book that publishes that shows that Trump was talking about how he knew that the coronavirus was more deadly than he had than he was saying publicly.
Got a roll, but thanks, Edward Isaac Dovere. The book is important.